Well, first of all, congratulations to David and Frank, and happy birthday to the KITP. Now, I'm going to aim in this talk to not say anything for specialists. And I'm also going to aim to end a little bit early to leave a little bit of time for questions, which in view of the first remark shouldn't come from specialists, but from people in other fields. So, I'm going to discuss a few questions. One will be why people work on string theory in the first place. The second will be what is string theory? And the last question is, can we connect string theory to particle physics? Well, the most basic reason for working on string theory is like the reason for climbing Mount Everest, which is that it's there. It's the only known generalization of standard quantum field theory that makes any sense. The framework that we came to work in the 20th century, based on special relativity plus quantum mechanics, is extremely rigid. It's the very rigidness of that framework. Well, first of all, it led to the development of quantum field theory in the first place. It practically forces quantum field theory upon us, and especially the so-called renormalizable ones at low energies, which are very scarce. It's the very rigidness of the framework that's one of the main reasons that particle physics made so much progress in the last century. If it was much easier to modify quantum field theory, we probably would have had much less success in advancing particle physics. So, we don't have any other ways that we can modify quantum field theory so that it makes any sense. String theory is really the only idea anyone has ever had that makes any sense for generalizing quantum field theory while preserving relativity and quantum mechanics. So, a big idea like a consistent generalization of quantum field theory only comes along every now and then, so we have to take it seriously. String theory, for example, emerged before I was in the field, and I don't think I personally ever would have attempted to invent something like that, because normally if you go off into the woods to search for a big idea like that, you don't come back. But in this case, that idea actually did emerge, and it's unnatural to ignore that. Now, in trying to develop string theory, physicists learned a number of interesting things which intensified the interest. My presentation isn't completely historical at all. It's not meant to be. It's meant to fit into the allowed time framework rather than to be historically accurate. But it was understood by the late 70s, or mid to late 70s and early 80s, that string theory forces general relativity upon us. Meaning, it forces upon us a framework which at large distances compared to the scale of the quantum effects looks like general relativity plus short distance corrections. That's important because standard quantum field theory makes general relativity impossible. So, string theory isn't just the only known generalization of standard quantum field theory, but it happens to make general relativity inevitable instead of impossible. It leads in a remarkably simple way, as was discovered maybe 10 years later in the mid-80s, to a reasonable rough draft of particle physics unified with gravity. Now, that's the good news. It has a flip side, which might be emphasized by some of the panelists, which is that there are uncomfortably many ways to get the rough draft, and it's frustratingly difficult to get the second draft. Still, it's very striking that such simple assumptions lead to a good approximation to particle physics unified with gravity. Moreover, string theory is incredibly rich. I actually think that even enthusiasts usually underestimate this. String theory is really fantastically rich. It's amazing how many secrets it has hidden. And it's generated amazing insights on topics from quantum field theory to four-manifold theory, some of them mentioned by previous speakers. This suggests that it's on the right track as a theory of nature, because to me it's implausible that physicists would invent a totally wrong theory, which would generate so many fantastic insights about so many different things. I don't think we're as clever as that, so I have to attribute it to the theory, not to us. And okay, I'll make one more remark about explaining why physicists study string theory. The last point I'll make is that where critics have good ideas, they tend to be absorbed as part of string theory. There frequently are people from this or that area who actually do have interesting ideas and have criticized string theory as not accommodating their ideas. And in an amazing number of cases, it's turned out that a little patience was required. And generally, once some other interesting ideas have made contact with string theory, after that it's happened in most cases. Some of these four that I've written here are relatively recent. But in most cases, it then turns out that further progress tends to be bound up with the relationships of the subject with string theory. But what is string theory? My second topic. Well, it may well be that string theory is the only way to reconcile gravity and quantum mechanics, which was the characterization of what string theory is that Weinberg suggested on Thursday. But that might be a true fact, but even if it is a true fact, it doesn't really quite tell us what string theory is. What is this theory that is alleged to be possibly the only way to unify gravity and quantum mechanics? So, to state it, as I think Weinberg did on Thursday, what's the core idea analogous to the principle of equivalence in the case of general relativity? Einstein based his theory as the mathematical embodiment of the principle of equivalence. What's the analog in the case of string theory? Well, the true statement that I can tell you about this most briefly is that we don't know. But I want to convey a few thoughts about it. And, well, actually, one thing I'll do is to respond to another common viewpoint of critics. One thing I can tell you is that though we don't know what's the analog of the principle of equivalence, one fact about this, which almost all string theorists think must be important in the answer, most string theorists suspect that what we know of as space-time is what condensed matter theorists tend to call an emergent phenomenon. This was actually mentioned by Sasha Polyakov and perhaps others among previous speakers. But most string theorists believe that in properly understanding string theory, microscopic reality is rather different, and macroscopically, space-time can emerge as an emergent phenomenon. That's sort of the normative outlook of string theorists and has been for around 20 years. What originally convinced us of this in the 1980s was an argument that I'll sketch by this little picture, with apologies to those who've heard me draw the same picture in colloquia, or perhaps other people drawing the same picture in colloquia 10 or 20 years ago. On the left, I have a Feynman diagram, understood the way Feynman did, as a history of particles propagating in space-time. Time runs vertically and space runs horizontally. And the lines are world paths of particles. Feynman said you have to integrate over all paths, but I drew the paths as simple straight lines to make it easier to see. Then there are these space-time events, the interaction vertices, where particles branch or recombine. So a definite space-time event plays a role in the quantum field theory. In going to the analogous string picture, the lines become little tubes that represent propagating strings. The tubes join smoothly, and there's no definite space-time event at which the interaction occurred. The process is actually local, but you can't pin down an event where the interaction occurred, because although in one Lorentz frame, there's a last moment right here where this string broke into two, in a different Lorentz frame, that would be somewhere else. So there's no invariant notion of a space-time event playing a different role. And that fuzziness of the event, I've drawn it here. Here I just have a particle breaking into two or a string breaking into two. There's a Lorentz invariant notion of where the particle branched, and there's no analogous notion for the string. This fuzziness of the event is a naive fact that leads to non-classical phenomena that several previous speakers mentioned, such as new symmetries, mirror symmetries, a new phenomena like topology changing transitions between different space-times that would not occur in standard geometry, but do occur in string theory. So these examples showed that there was some inherent fuzziness of the concept of space-time, leading string theorists to see space-time as an emergent phenomenon in some way we didn't understand. What I've very briefly mentioned were our best clues in the 80s, but in the 90s, we discovered a new set of clues suggesting that space-time can somehow be built out of matrix or gauge degrees of freedom. So the most beautiful example of this, but it really would take a whole lecture in itself, is the so-called ADS-CFT correspondence, where the same reality can be described in either of two ways. In the bulk is the interior of the cylinder, the solid cylinder. In the bulk, you have quantum gravity or string theory, and on the boundary, you have gauge theory. So one gets a dictionary between gauge theory and gravity, showing that quantum gravity and space-time can emerge as an alternative description of something built microscopically from gauge theory or matrix degrees of freedom. Now it was, okay, so among other things, it's useful for understanding black hole entropy and quark confinement and various other things in new ways. And it gives an example, as one previous speaker mentioned, where you can give an exact definition, non-perturbatively, of string theory. But the construction starts out being incredibly special. But once one has this gauge gravity correspondence in a special case, one can work out all kinds of generalizations. For one thing, one obvious thing is that one can make relevant perturbations of the gauge theory. One can make what condensed matter physicists call relevant perturbations. Once one starts with a gauge theory, one can perturb it by adding new operators to the Hamiltonian. That has to do something to the geometry. So one generalizes the gauge gravity correspondence depending on all kinds of relevant perturbations you can make. And there are many other, there's an incredible variety of related constructions you can make. So you end up learning that once you find out that one gauge theory has a gravitational interpretation, in fact, an incredible variety of them do. Well, it's hard to see where to stop. And since there's no obvious place to stop, maybe you shouldn't. Maybe every quantum mechanical system has a dual gravitational interpretation, which in general would be strongly curved and highly unsemi-classical and very hard to understand in terms of our intuitive notion of geometry. The question must then be turned around. Which quantum mechanical systems correspond to macroscopic semi-classical spacetimes like the one we live in? I don't know how close that is to the right question to ask, but it might be the best question we can ask as of 2004. I'd assume that even now we only understand a few fragments of this story. And I'm not, some speakers varied in how much they were willing to go out on a limb. And I'm afraid I'm not one of those who goes way out on limbs. So I'm only going to say that it's plausible that we'll eventually manage to understand what string theory is. Probably one of them. Now, to get to my third subject, which had to do with what we might succeed in using it for, even if this occurs, that is, if we manage to understand what string theory actually is, and even if it's on the right track, there's a real question about whether we'll be able to learn how to use it to understand nature. And I actually think that among critics of string theory, those who merely say that it's too big a leap for humans to take have the strongest point. It's, as I tried to explain at the beginning, unnatural to not try to pretend that something like that wasn't discovered and not develop it would be highly unnatural. But in the end, we don't know how far we'll be able to get with it. It depends on a lot of unknowns. For one thing, we don't know how complex the answer is. We don't know really what clues we're going to be able to get from experiment. We don't know how the clues and the answer are correlated. So we can be pretty sure that we won't get there if we don't try. I suppose that's another prediction I'm willing to make. But as for how far we'll get by trying, I don't know. It would help a lot if supersymmetry, which is an important part of the string theory story, is actually relevant to electroweak symmetry breaking, as is suggested by some clues that were mentioned in the panel on Thursday. And in that case, hopefully, can be studied at accelerators, perhaps giving us clues that would enable us to go much farther. So I'll stop here and invite questions from non-specialists, non-string people who work in other, physicists who work in other fields. What?
You want a few of your own questions?
Yes. Yes?
Yes, you emphasize that string theory requires spatial relativity.
Yes.
There has been some suggestions that
maybe perhaps at the Planck scale. There have been some suggestions that at the Planck scale there might be violations of Lorentz invariance. Could you comment on those suggestions?
Well, it's always good to have new experiments suggested and stimulated, and testing special relativity as well as possible is extremely important. So sometimes a new measurement is simulated by a totally wacky theory. And that's good if the totally wacky theory stimulates an improved measurement. Some of that might be what's happening here. Yes?
Could you tell us a little bit more? I realize you need an hour, but whatever time the chair will allow you, about this ADS CFT theory for those of us who have only heard about it at this meeting.
Well, I can tell you a little bit more. I didn't plan a 2-minute or 5-minute version, so I'm improvising. But there's a space-time. The boundary is actually infinitely far away, but I've projected it to a finite distance just so I can draw it here. So here's a bound. This is a an ideal boundary at infinity.
And what sort of sample dimension?
The original, actually, in Juan's original paper, the examples, the gravitational theory was in 4, 5, or 7 dimensions, and the boundary theory was in 1 dimension less, therefore. If you want to study quark confinement, you want the boundary to be 4-dimensional and the bulk 5-dimensional, because you want to do quark confinement in 4 dimensions. Quark confinement is a phenomenon in gauge theory. So you can map quark confinement in 4-dimensional gauge theory to a question about black holes in 5 dimensions. On the other hand, if you want to study gravity, you're more interested in the case where the bulk is 4-dimensional, the boundary is therefore 3-dimensional, and you describe 4-dimensional gravity in terms of phenomena in 3-dimensional gauge theories. As for the way you make the mapping, I probably should resist too much of a detailed explanation now. But you study the behavior of a field in the interior as it approaches the boundary. And from the leading coefficients, you define a quantum field in the boundary theory. And then correlation functions in the boundary are mapped to observables in the interior. It's a little bit analogous. If you think of the S matrix as something you measure at the far past and the far future, so it's defined at infinity, but it captures information about what happened in the interior. I think I'd better resist the temptation to tell you more, given that there are other questions and not much time. Yes, Gwen? Yes. Yes. That's the conventional view of string theorists now. The conventional view of string theorists in 1990, or a little earlier, when you and I worked together on string theory, was that the space-time was emergent, but the string was fundamental. But I think that now the conventional view is that space-time and the string are both emergent phenomena. And, of course, we don't know what from. I can just tell you that ideas that are based on this, that spin off of this ADS-CFT correspondence, are the most popular current ideas now, but they might only reflect one part of the reality. Yes?
If LHC doesn't see supersymmetry, which Steve Weinberg told us keeps him awake at night, would your confidence in string theory as the description of reality still be intact?
Well, depending on what the LHC finds, my optimism about how well we can understand whatever the deeper theory is might go down. As for I think my I honestly think that I would, I think that there are a lot of circumstantial reasons that I tried to summarize in the first part of the talk when I explained why physicists study string theory, to think that it's a good thing to study and it's probably on the right track. But how far we'll get with it depends on how lucky we are with the clues we're able to get from experiments, and also on the nature of the answer, how close the clues we can get are to the answer, and how clever we are. There are all kinds of imponderables. So bad news from the LHC would definitely lessen the hopes of being able to get farther in understanding how it really works.
Ed, I wonder if I could ask you for another 3-minute tutorial. You said that, that mirror symmetry derived from the lack of a well-defined separation point when springs topologically separate?
Well, that's a necessary condition. There's more to it, of course. But
I was just asking for the next 3 minutes.
Yeah. If you know how to multiply functions in space-time, you can reconstruct space-time points. So mathematically, from the Feynman graph in phi cube theory, you can reconstruct space-time, because built into the graph is the multiplication law of functions. But there's no analogous way to reconstruct space-time from a conformal field theory whose target is space-time. And therefore, it's possible for the same conformal field theory to be obtained starting from different space-times. That leads to non-classical symmetry, such as mirror symmetry, and non-classical processes, such as topology change.
Many of the things that I talk to you are about this landscape idea about cosmology.
Many of the string theorists who I talk to are adopting this landscape idea with anthropic implications for cosmology. I'd be curious to get your take on that.
Well, there's some. I'd be happy if it's not right, because I'd be happy to have a more unique understanding of the universe that it would allow. But there are some serious arguments for it, which we'll probably hear more about in the next panel. And I regrettably don't have any serious counter-arguments at the moment. I would have given them to you if I had them.
Any questions? Okay, I'm going to start.